Thank you, Michel, for this very circumstantial introduction, which puts me in front of you here today in a quite uncomfortable position for a couple of reasons. One is has already been disclosed here by Michel Lackner. One other would be that we are just all coming back from the winter break, and maybe some of us, and me included, are still in holiday or vacation mode, so coming back to more not so terrestrial but still topics, academic topics, might not be the easiest endeavor on the 7th of January. The main difficulty, what makes me quite not so comfortable here, is that this is not the kind of talk I usually give, like I was telling Professor Rutkin this morning. Normally, as Michel Lackner mentioned when introducing me, I deal with very detailed or precise divination method techniques, very obscure, and while shielding myself beyond plenty of old books that I can throw to the audience as some kind of decoy to distract your attention away from the lack of consistency of my talk. Today, I unfortunately won't be doing this. The main reason being, this is a rather new work for me. This is the first step of the work I was willing to do while staying here at the IKGF, and in that regard, it is a very textual oriented, more very pedestrian kind of research, text based, and not so much about objects or detailed techniques. So when we say in Japanese, I am here in front of you with my bare waist, marugoshi, which means unarmed, without any kind of decoy or totem. To be clear, I won't be talking today about divination. Although this is usually what I do, I won't be talking today about divination proper, but rather about how people involved with divination or mantic matters changed their frame of mind at the beginning, at the end of the 17th century and beginning of the 18th. So it's not so much about how people were doing divination in Japan or what kind of divination was being used in Japan, in early modern Japan, but mostly how people involved with divination tend to see the world anew at a given time period. So we will see that a generation of non-professional scholars, and I insist very much on this point, non-professional scholars with a technical knowledge rather than a speculative one, tried to address several issues regarding cosmology, calendar, or divination, and with or without influence from Western modern philosophy and science, so that we will see that the kind of discourses they produced were attempts to reshape the framework through which people saw the very notion of destiny and how to cope with the determinism inherent to fate prognostication. So in that regard, this is also a part of what I have been doing for several years now, that is to try to integrate mantic arts and cosmology as a part of a social history of knowledge. On topic, late 17th century Japan might not be the time period most of you are familiar with, and I'm very well aware of that. However, I cannot do here a history class, so I will have to remain very precise and focus on a few aspects. What we call early modern or pre-modern Japan runs from the beginning of the 17th century to more globally the late 19th, and this is what we call Edo Japan. Edo being the main or supposedly main city, at least the shogunal, the capital of the shogun, as opposed to Kyoto, which remained the capital of the emperor, or the king, if you prefer. What is remarkable about 17th century Japan is that at the end of that first century of the Edo period, the expansion of printed culture, books, allowed for a further disclosure of knowledge and practices that used to be reserved to a cultural, if not political, elite, such as monks, courtiers, and warriors. So this disclosure of knowledge is one of the main features of what we may see as a rupture from the medieval model, where the transmission of knowledge was mainly done in a secret fashion through mainly religious circles, or court circles, or elite circles, but all of these spheres were globally mixed. This phenomenon of disclosure, which stands as one of the key features to characterize Tokugawa Japan as modern, and I insist here again on the word modern rather than early or pre-modern, cannot be explained only by its medium, that is books. It's not only because we have books that such a disclosure could have taken place. It also implies that individuals were willing to share their knowledge with others. And this is precisely the kind of individuals I am willing to talk about today. This new clerism, to coin the word used by Peter Burke to characterize Western development in the Renaissance and mainly the Enlightenment period, this new clerism not only contributed to the diffusion of ideas present already around, but also to establish new paradigms in various fields. In that regard, what took place after the isolation should be noted. What I call here isolation, maybe you're familiar or not with that notion. This is the idea that from the 1630 onwards, the ban on Catholicism and Christianism led to a closure of Japanese border frontiers, sea borders. This is a very debatable idea. Nowadays, we don't talk so much about isolation. By we, I mean in the field of Japanese history, we don't emphasize the isolated aspect. It was more a feature to avoid people getting out. But what is important here is that until this mid-17th century, Japanese were everywhere in East Asia and exchanging with China and Southern Asia with a lot of contacts. Christians and missionaries, Jesuits, Portuguese, Spanish were all around the place in the south of Japan. So this was a very different kind of world than after. But yet, consequences can be seen, I think, later in the 17th century. And this is what happened after the isolation. Namely, what took place in what we call the Jōkyō Shōtoku era, which is around the 1680, is not totally unlike the revolution initiated in Europe by Descartes, Leibniz, and later Newton. In other words, what we have from the 1680 is secular authors willing to discuss, if not to criticize, what was taken for granted until then, and yet to formulate new theories. And this is most noticeably the case after the year 1684, what happened in 1684 is that a lay scholar, not coming from the aristocracy, not coming from a family trained originally in astronomy or calendar, named Shibukawa Harumi, designed the first Japanese calendar in 800 years. Which means that prior to that date, 1684, Japanese have been using the old Chinese calendar as the standard way of measuring time. So you can imagine it was totally lagging, but still it was the case at that point. And Shibukawa did not just took the new, it wasn't an update, taking the new Chinese calendar. He actually inputted and the distance between China and Japan to take into account the difference of time frame between both countries, and so that the calendar devised by Shibukawa was supposed to be most the most fitting for Japan proper. And we can say this is a sort of experimental breakthrough which led to the devising of the first properly Japanese calendar. So most noticeably, it was in the field of astronomy, meteorology, and even cosmology that discussion arose during the late 17th century. And conversely, commonplace ideas shared by commoners, that's why they are called commonplace, I think, regarding cosmology or even religion, were also put under a closer scrutiny by these scholars. The Confucian notion that incorrect beliefs could become a cause of social trouble had made its way through their mind, and some of them became eager to enlighten the ill-tutored on these topics. So this is where it comes to the notion of rationality and or rationalism. Usually when talking about rationalism in a Sino-Japanese way, we go directly to Neo-Confucian metaphysic of Li and Ti. This is not what I will be talking about today. By rationalism, what I try to express here is that the general idea of Tokugawa or Edo Japan as more rational than medieval and even older Heian, Japan is not as obvious as it seems. And it does require a closer look. Of course, the growing influence of Confucianism inevitably led to a criticism toward medieval notions inherited from Buddhism. So this is a basic opposition between Confucian and Buddhist, which we were reminded of several times by Professor Kliman when he was still with us. That does not mean, however, that Edo scholars went on a global vendetta against religious beliefs and what has been called superstitions after the Meiji Restoration, that is, after the end of the Edo period. We don't talk about superstition here in Edo Japan. The word does not exist. The word that will be used later in the 19th century in China and Japan, there is a debate about which one came first, I think. As a matter of fact, the whole system on which Chinese physics is based, namely the yin-yang and five phases, as well as most of its applications, survived almost unscratched through the whole Edo period. However, the striking change one can see since at least the late 17th century is a general tendency not to consider the correctness of discourses as a the correctness of discourses as guaranteed by their pedigree or pervasiveness through history. What I mean here is that these scholars, new clerisy, non-professional, that we will be talking about, went on with a systematic research of what I would call reasonable causes within the given logical philosophical framework given by Confucianism, or that is the yin yang and five phases and other elements. But what is important here is that they were trying to get rid of what we may call occult influence, hidden influences. There is nothing is hidden, everything is in plain sight. So this is a broad and important change of paradigm in the perception of what knowledge is and is supposed to be. And this kind of movement, critical movement, rationalistic movement, is usually associated with late 18th century philology. What I call here philology is a standard word for what we call kōsōgaku in Japanese, literally the study of the proofs, the school of the proofs, which is said to have been developed in Qing China from the 18th century onward. However, I would argue that 17th century premises should not by no means be overlooked, for they stand as condition of possibility of later developments. That kind of new rationalism has critical discourses as a core feature. What I mean here by critical discourses is a kind of discourses about what is true, what is false, and why. And here we can find the notion of proof. Although this might not be what you would expect in terms of proofing or proving, it's not experimental science as we may consider it today, but still one has to prove his point through different means. We find famous illustrations of this within the history of thoughts, history of ideas. For example, a prominent scholar called Ito Jinsai was an early critic of the Neo-Confucian Chengzhu school, of the Cheng brothers and Andrew Xi, while Ogyu Sorai, who was one of his late adversary, was also critical of Chinese Neo-Confucianism. But if we set aside this kind of very famous scholars labeled as representative by history of idea, we can try to turn to more empiric scholars who had an actual influence on specialists in several fields. So this is not about how Confucianism became new or more critical in Japan. It is about how scholars specialized in several fields, namely here astronomy, calendar, divination, and even medicine, became aware of that new critical paradigm. These people had access to specialized knowledge, and they started questioning the established framework, which was on which their own practice was grounded. I would then argue that the role of lesser study scholars who were writing technical books, mainly in vernacular Japanese rather than in Chinese, should not be overlooked. And if we set aside Jinsai's case, we can observe that critical works were gathering momentum since the late 17th century in various schools and shapes. The literati scholars of the late 17th century of different obedience were trying to make their voices heard on various topics with a common and individual goal. I'm not saying that they were all in the same state of mind, but each individual endeavor concurred to create a new quasi-macro-sociological phenomenon. Common because they attempted in their own ways to distinguish between true and false, but also individual because the answers were not necessarily the same. So what were they doubting about? What was doubtful to these scholars? Mainly what I would call traditional views. Traditional as in medieval, and mainly religious, that is Buddhist. representation, as opposed to Confucianist one, of course. But most of all, the main problem these kind of scholars had was with arbitrary correlations in traditional sciences and arts, such as calendar, astronomy, medicine, and, of course, divination. So who will I be focusing on today? Two individuals that you probably never heard of, and even people doing Japanese history won't have heard of them, so don't worry about that. Baba Nobutake was a Kyoto physician, formerly a lecturer in Monzeki-ji, is a temple run by an imperial prince. He claimed to come from a famous Baba family from the Kai province, which is the actual Yamanashi prefecture, so there were a lot of warlords coming from there. His curriculum set aside. Why is this man important? Because he was a prolific author in various fields, but mainly on divination and astronomy, and even phonetics, etc. He wrote maybe 10 different divination guides and manuals during his late life, which were republished up to well into the 20th century. So we cannot understand the history of Japanese divination without this Baba Nobutake. On the other side, we have Nishikawa Joken, who is among the first non-professional astronomer. He is remarkable because he lived in Nagasaki and had numerous contacts with both people from Ming and Qing China, but also with people from the West who were transiting or staying in Nagasaki, which was the only, at some point, which became the only point of access to Japan from the outside. So this astronomer from Nagasaki studied with Christian-related master Hayashi Kichizaemon, and he came from a merchant family in charge of measuring silk threads, meaning that he was trained to use numbers. And he is a prolific author of astronomy and geography-related books. So we have both here two polymath that had an important imprint on the field of commoner knowledge. The two of them probably never met. However, the publication records of both authors tend to overlap. Joken first published work came out in 1695, and Baba's first book came out in 1697. What is more, there is only a 2 years interval between Baba's treatise on astronomy and Nishikawa's first book on the same topic. Both books owing much to another text, which is called the Tenkei Wakumon, a book in Chinese presenting Western astronomy, later censored by the Bakufu. Finally, they both publish a work the same year, bearing the word Bendan in the title, which one of them being one of the books I will talk about today. So, overlapping publication, long-standing influence, reprints of their works until the end of Edo and beyond, these were what I would call physicists. Well, Baba was a physician, but also in that regard a physicist, and also metaphysicians like Cardanus or Descartes may have been. And I like here to convoke Descartes, because we tend to think about of him as the parangon of the new way of thinking in Western in the Western world, where we are here talking about someone who argued against the circulation of blood and who defended the idea that the universe was full
vortexes.
Thank you. So if we put Descartes as the early example of Western rationalism, I argue that Baba and Joken can definitely be seen as Descartes' equivalent in Japan. What will be here under scrutiny? Two texts by these authors. The first is Baba's critic of value theories, Chaussette's Benda. And the other will be Nishikawa's Kyodo Rekidan. Chaussette's Benda is actually more akin to another work by Nishikawa, which I will talk about just now. To present them very shortly, Baba's critic of various theories is his only essay. Beside this, he only published manuals in vernacular or commentaries of Chinese classics. Nishikawa also published a Bendan, a critic about strange phenomena, but this is a very different book dealing only with meteorology. So I won't talk about this one today, but rather about another book by Nishikawa, Kyodo Rekidan, Calendar Pedagogy, published 1 year before Baba's book, but later republished 2 years later as a guide to the circulation of energy in China and Japan, Wakan Unki Shinan Koheng. So while Baba's was an essay pertaining to the genre of the miscellaneous notes, Zuichzi, Joken's book is more a guide to understand calendar prognostications. Both of them are rather belong to rather technical fields and develop technical arguments. I will try here to highlight the similarities and differences between these two works in order to shed light on the goals and methods scholars such as Baba or Nishikawa had when devising their books and how consequential the position they adopted may have been in terms of change of paradigm in cosmological view or in the view fate or destiny was perceived, in the way fate or destiny was perceived, were perceived. What is difficult here is that there is no continuous demonstration as we may be used to in the West. One has to reconstruct the general discourse of both of these books. So, getting into the matter now, the Chaussette's Benda is divided in three chapters with no general orientation for each and deals with three main topics: religious beliefs and representations, calendar, astronomy, medicine, and other sciences, and also linguistics, that is, the reading of character, origin of words, etc. So, the Chaussette's Benda's main concern, as you could see, is to get rid of that kind of thing. This is a picture of hell, the old lady at the entry of hell that gets all your clothes off. This does not exist. Same for here, the Bodhisattva Jizo, another figure in hell. This does not exist either. That doesn't mean this has no meaning. Both of them have a meaning and can be explained through yin-yang, five phases, cosmology or physics. The sources and aims of Baba's book is to put common beliefs and assumptions, what we call here sets, discourses, under a close scrutiny. We can see in Baba's book a strong influence of other works, mainly Chinese, and chiefly Xie Zhaozhi, Wu Zazi, the Five Miscellanies, published 100 years before. But it also takes the shape of a response to other critical works from different schools, such as Isao Banliu's Zokusetsu Ben, the critic of popular opinions, or another book by a Buddhist monk. So this, the Banliu's book is about Japanese divinities, what we call Shinto, while Unsho's is about Buddhism. And this book by Baba is for ignorance of beginners, what we call Domo, Gumo, Hatsugaku, etc. It exposes in each item, each entry, the topic it will deal with, and some sources, and it discusses it, mostly through the form of refutation, with extensive quotation of old and new Chinese works, even of works that were long forgotten in China, like the Wuxing Tai that was translated by Mark Kalinowski at the Compendium des Cinq Agents. We find expression of the author's own opinion and also a need to put the full quote in Chinese at the end of each article, so to demonstrate not only that his allegations are not based on thin air, but on actual pieces of text he can show to anyone who would ask. He will often resort to the expression "Gu anzurini," in my humble opinion, to dismiss what he considered as delusional theories, totally wrong theories, totally false theories, despicable, laughable, the theory of a dilettante. This is what he says about Zhong Kui, whose people doing a Chinese study might be familiar with. It's a famous figure with a big bear, and he considers that this was just some kind of joke, a song thinker. And he will often also consider that one cannot see the reason of this argument, Li Gamies. So his stance is of a strong critic of Buddhism. Most sutras are fake. Most Sanskrit words are in fact Chinese or Japanese words. His critic is of pervasive misunderstandings and quiproquo regarding common assumptions and mainly of arbitrary beliefs, but also of arbitrary criticism, as we will see just now. One must know the text, whether they are Buddhist, Confucian, or Japanese, etc., and everything can be explained by the cosmological system and illustrated by the hexagram of the I Ching. Thus, although we have and we need to verify by asking or observing, which he tells us he did himself. So he was looking for coherency and consistency, past and present. For example, he argues that the idea that the earth is square and the sky is round is not literal. So ancient Chinese were not wrong in assuming that the earth was square and the sky round. They were just not literal. Just one, I'm not sure we'll have time enough, but just at least one item here. The word urabom, urambana in Sanskrit, which is a Buddhist festival of the dead. We have this word in Japanese, urabom, translation of the Sanskrit urambana through Chinese, but to Baba Nobutake, this is a Japanese word. Furthermore, it is in fact the back of a tray which resembles the hexagram that can be attributed to the 7 months of the year. You see the hexagram of the I Ching on the left, and on the right you have a tray, a reversed tray. On the same kind of idea, the Indian god Mahakara, which was conveyed to Japan through Buddhism, is he or not a Japanese god? People of the Shinto school would argue that he isn't, that he is, in fact, a Japanese and not Indian god. And here, Baba considers that one should follow Buddhist text rather than Japanese one, Shinto, or even Confucian views. And he has similar arguments on other deities, but still everything can be explained through the I Ching hexagrams, and this is Daikokuten Mahakara, which in fact represents this trigram. The broken lines at the bottom stand for the bowls of rice. Same from this deity here, which is in fact this hexagram here. The two dots up are the horns, and at the bottom you have the legs. But more importantly, Baba has here a stance, a position very clear about a new vision of the cosmos and the auspicious or inauspicious character of stars, which is not inherent to the stars. I will just go directly to the quotation here. Common people are bewildered when they see comets and guess stars appearing in heaven, and some among them even become terribly anxious, as if expecting an imminent disaster such as famine or upheaval. I won't read through everything, but just this is ridiculous because the sky is large and covers all the country, yada yada yada. This has no roots in actual cosmology, what he considers to be actual cosmology. And what is more, the sky is mindless. So he cannot show signs to people deliberately. And he further demonstrates why the sky is mindless, etc., etc. So in that regard, old and ancient accounts, even those who involved famous figures like Abenoseime, famous diviner of the Heian period, who supposedly divined the dismissal, the eviction of Emperor Kazan from planetary alignments, was in fact fraud. Seimei famous act was in fact a fraud. I have to go back a little bit. So, although there is no explicit reference to Western astronomy in Baba's work, one cannot fail but see what he may have found in text introducing Western astronomy, like the Tenkei Wakuman I mentioned earlier. But still, the prevalence of Yin-Yang cosmology is quite striking, but has to be merged with the confrontation to experimental truths, which has to be dealt with. So it's not only a theory, it also has to be adapted in function of experience. If I go now to Joken, in his Kyodo Rekidan, we have no divisions at all. Joken's book follows the items one can find in calendars or calendar-related books, that is cosmological elements, chronomantical divisions, chronomantical markers, etc. We find several recurring arguments common to other works by the same author, and what is very notable here is that Western knowledge is presented for the sake of intellectual curiosity. What's that? Oh, yeah, that should not be here. That was another thing by Baba. I don't know why and how it ended up here. Anyway, this is the idea that astromancy, classic astromancy, is a totally arbitrary theory. So this is a calendar, usual calendar, so Joken's book follow that kind of content. I cannot obviously develop that now. Joken explains each item when possible with a very few rejections and some strong confirmations. For example, he says that we should keep the habit to choose day, pickup day for acupuncture. But he discusses the validity or efficiency of these notions in comparison with Western, Indian, and Indian calendar, etc. So thus, he is mostly prescriptive. He's sometimes prescriptive, but mostly discursive. His sources, on the contrary from Baba, are not Chinese books, but calendars from China and Japan and China. And his main point in this book is that hemerology or calendar relevance or efficacy is overall disputable, but it cannot be avoided. Thus, it should be done in the less harmful way as possible. Joken blames mainly Chinese diviners after the Warring State period for implementing arbitrary prognostications. So in his mind, it is not because an affirmation or a notion, calendar, astrological, divinatory notion is all that it is necessarily true. He looks for proofs of efficacy and discrepancies between countries and people, etc. Regarding astrology and astronomy, his point is that all that can be clearly explained by the five phases or agent cycle is acceptable, provided it has a proven fixed efficacy. For example, in some cases he will say that although it seems reasonable, it is difficult to believe in a systematic efficacy. And regarding, for example, prognostics for the daily mention of the Big Dipper, something there are daily mentions every day, depending on the position of the Dipper in the sky, were invented by diviners and are of no concern to modern astronomers. So he makes a very clear distinction between the two functions here. On the auspicious and inauspicious character of the stars, we have an air of déjà vu here. He tells us that the divination of these fluctuations have been discussed by astromancers in China and Japan, past and present, countless times. I don't know how relevant were the prognostics in ancient China, but nowadays there are numerous inconsistencies. And more importantly, the constellations are not moving just for China and Japan, but in fact for all the countries in the world. His main source for asserting such notions comes from the verification through direct interaction with Chinese people. For example, regarding a feature called the annual trigram, the Nenke, he states that no one knows where the habit to attribute a trigram to each year comes from. Some say it was Rajan Shotoku and others that it was Abe no Seimei, the old guy from earlier. As for me, I could have a look to some scriptures by Ming visitors. So his reference is what actual Chinese people he met were telling or letting him see, at least. Changing the science of heaven for Joken implies that the revolved around a few points. One that he has been told by a Chinese visitor is that years are unique, as is man, so that he will negate and reject the correlative properties of the sexagenary cycle and of the actual devising of calendar prognostication in Japan and China. To replace this arbitrary he proposes to emphasize the differences between country through geography, what he calls Chile here, which is in fact a word for what we call the climate theory, which was made known anew by Montesquieu a few years later. Geography is the key to an accurate understanding of cosmological movements. And astromancy, Tianwen, Tenmon, now comes after every other cosmological sciences such as calendar, Leikigaku, astrology or astronomy, Seigaku, geography, Chirigaku, and today's heavenly science, Tengaku, Tianxue. So this is not the usual word for astrology or astromancy. It is a different word, the science of heaven. Focusing on calendar calculations and stellar observation only without knowing geography won't benefit much to today's heavenly science. One must be learned in calendar, stars, and geography before discussing astromancy. So, to sum it up, the similarities and differences between those two authors, we could see that both have a critical attitude, critical discourse, toward what is usually considered as established or even toward new interpretation, as it was the case, for example, for that Indian god. This was a new interpretation to say, no, this god is Japanese. This was a new way of thinking it, but it was also discussed. And at the same time, like Baba, like I said earlier, Baba was critical of arbitrary criticism. One must stop. One must refrain from his intent to reject Buddhism. When Buddhism is right, one should say Buddhism is right. So, in some cases, we have reasonable doubt. This is doubtful. This is unproven. And in other cases, we have overt skepticism on both parts. The main concern is definitely to get rid of arbitrary assumptions, what they call totally false theory, totally untrue theory, etc. And in order to do that, they will go to what I would dare to call a quasi-Humean view. To some extent, they need to resort to experiments such as personal calculations. Baba complains in one of his other books that he was not able to understand how the new calendar was made. So that meaning that he tried actually to redo the calculations from the Chinese calendar. And like I said, he questioned his own students, medical students, about the situation in, for example, their own province, country of place of birth, of origin, about their customs, etc. He would have gone to see stars at night to check if they were indeed like it was said in books, etc. And Joken did the same and interrogate when he could Chinese people and had this knowledge from the West coming to him as well. So calculation, observation, questioning, they have to some extent an experimental point of view. Maybe we can find a less ideological positioning in Joken's work than in Baba's, and that might be caused by the social differences between the two. Like I said, Baba is supposedly a warrior when Joken is a merchant. Warriors are the leaders of the society, while merchants are at the bottom, although they are the richest, of course, of all. Still, they both keep and defend strong cosmological views, the circulation of energy, the Unti for Joken, and climate theory, and on the other hand, the eating-based analogical thinking for Baba. So Baba's physics is basically illustrated by the hexagrams of the eating. The major difference, and this is only a formal one, is that Baba's book is full of quotation, while Joken's book is devoid of any. So, quotation for Baba, while Joken has direct sources. So to conclude, I would like to put up some questions. Is such a phenomenon I try to introduce today a legacy, an influence, does it proceed from an influence of Chinese philology, and only that, or is it a local invention, a local development that happened to resonate, to become joint with, to happen jointly with the Chinese philology? Like I said earlier, we have this generation of non-professional scholars with a technical knowledge rather than a speculative one, taking discourses as object of discussion, discourses that can be true or mistaken, but that need to be proven. So this actually prefigurates later specialized schools, like what we call the study of our country, the nationalistic or nativist studies that take off during the late 18th century. But also, we can see the indirect influence of Western modern philosophy and science through climate theory and astronomy. But the fact that the people like Joken or Baba consider the extension of knowledge as a mean to reach a greater objectivity, to me indicates some sort of resonance between Japan and Europe at that given time. And this is not a matter of influence, of course, it's mostly a matter of what kind of society we had at that time in Japan and in Europe. And this is why, again, I think it is really important to reintegrate cosmological or astrological historical studies in their social framework, to see that, for example, here, such discourses attempted to reshape a framework through which people saw the very notion of destiny and how to cope with the determinism inherent to fate prognostication, but it could only happen because social cultural context produced such scholars that would in turn create that kind of criticism. And I think this is one, and if not the main feature we should reflect upon when dealing with our topics. It's not only about describing Japan for the sake of Japan, as if isolated of everything else. It's not about saying that Japan copied things from China or the West, but rather to see what kind of social-cultural phenomena happen in similar contexts and why. And this is where I should stop. Thank you very much.